Today's program has been brought to you by White Oak Pastures, a five-generation Georgia-based beef and poultry farm determined to conduct business in an honorable manner. For more information, visit whiteoakpastures.com.
Host of Radio Cherry Bomb, you're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Inside School Food. I'm your host, Laura Stanley, and I've got something good for you today, School Gardens to Cafeteria. My guests are Andy Nowak, director of the National School Garden Program for Slow Food USA, and Rick Sherman, farm to school and school garden coordinator at the Oregon Department of Education. I think it's going to be lively because Andy and Rick are not just good friends, but fellow Energizer bunnies. Both are national leaders, not just in school gardening, but the movement to introduce student-grown produce into school meals. We're going to find out from them what this looks like in different settings and steps school gardeners and school food service professionals can take together to make it happen, and, most important, why it's worth the effort. So good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Good morning, Laura.
Yeah, so I'm going to start out west and work my way inland to Andy. Okay, so we'll start introducing Rick. Rick was brought on by the Oregon Department of Education 2 years ago, 2012, as farm to school and school garden coordinator after being a food service management professional for 32 years. So you kind of crossed over from there, Rick. And the 20 of those years he spent as a school food service director throughout Oregon in Eugene, Albany, and Dallas, Oregon. And Rick is a master gardener, which is something that came to him on his last job in Eugene, and that's something we'll be talking about shortly. And Andy at Slow Food USA, Andy is building capacity of Slow Food chapters to be partners in school garden projects. He got his start in this work in his hometown of Denver, where he spearheaded the development of a robust network of gardens throughout the district and Slow Food Denver seed-to-table school food program. I should add for those listeners who heard our June 2nd episode about local sustainable chicken in Jefferson County, Colorado, you will recall that that was a Slow Food Denver project as well, and Andy was at the helm there too. He's a Hall of Fame chef with Share Our Strength Cooking Matters program and was one of six chefs invited to the White House in 2010 to help develop the Chefs Moves to School program. So, school gardens are hugely popular, more so all the time, especially now that we have a kind of national school garden at the White House. USDA is attempting to keep track. Its farm-to-school census indicates we may have edible gardens in as many as 31% of schools nationwide. How many of these are supplying food to the cafeteria is anyone's guess, except in Oregon, where Rick Sherman's office is painstakingly keeping track of that as well. So, Rick, what do you know, and how did you find out?
Yeah, it was a process, that was for sure. The first day on my job here, I asked the question how many school gardens there were in Oregon, and of course no one knew that number, and I said, well, I should find out, and I was pretty much told that I shouldn't try because it was a difficult process to do to figure out how many school gardens there were. And so, you know, my thing is, well, never tell me I can't do something, right? So I went about a task of starting to call every school. You know, I work for the Department of Education, so we have lots of lists of phone numbers. So I just took 20 minutes a day for 3 months, and I just called every school in the state with a simple question of, do you have a school garden? And Once I answered that question, I had a list and populated a map, which was on our school garden website, and then we've since gone back and found out a school garden coordinator or somebody in charge for every one of those gardens, and we're starting to ask more questions, like, you know, go circle back with them and find out exactly how many of them are serving food from their garden, how many has you know, garden-based education taking place, and so on. We've actually, the next step in this process is to get it. We got it approved to the National School Lunch Program process here in Oregon, where food service directors reapply every year, and that piece is a part of it now on the school garden piece, where they answer some questions about their school gardens in their state.
Right, so you won't have to hand count anymore. Only Oregon's doing that, right?
I'm sorry?
Only Oregon is doing that, making that part of the re-up application?
Yes, yeah, that's okay. Currently a part of that as we speak.
Great. So, and apparently you found out in making these painstaking calls over 3 months that fully half of how many gardens in Oregon, school gardens?
We have 513 as of today.
Right, so fully half of them are actually supplying some amount of food to the cafeteria, which is pretty remarkable. What do you know about the kind of range of that in terms of the volumes that the gardens are supplying to these schools?
Well, that part as of today is anecdotal. We just know of a lot of instances of garden produce going into the cafeteria, and just in my visits and around the state, there's some as much as large volumes of large gardens where they have almost a mini farm, or they have just some raised beds on, you know, it just depends what is going on at that particular school. But, you know, one of the arguments against getting garden produce into the cafeteria is that, oh, we just don't have enough to supply the whole school body. And I found that really to be not the case as far as an argument.
Right. You said to me when we spoke about this earlier that a little can be just as impactful as a lot. So that's
yeah.
You know, yeah. Tell me about that.
Well, yeah. And my last food service, nutrition services management job that I had before I have my current job was in Eugene, Oregon. And one of my schools had a school garden day there, and I showed up, and we had a half hotel pan of green leaf lettuce from the garden. That was all they could supply after the garden education pieces, where the kids are out in the garden and they're eating some of the produce out there or whatever. So they had this. They advertised it. You know, they had it in their bulletin. Every kid just about came in and got a school lunch that day. What was more, we had two TV stations that were local there in Eugene showed up. The local newspaper showed up, as well as National Public Radio, all there taking pictures of this one little half hotel pan, and all the kids got a little taste of it. It was the most amazing thing I ever saw, and that just hit it home so much, and I use that story quite a bit. This is, you know, a one little pan, you'd be surprised what a big deal that is to the kids.
Yeah, I love that story. I really do. And so at this point, so Eugene was your last school food service director job, and it was the first district in which you decided to get involved with gardens. What was it about Eugene that made it happen for you there?
Well, Eugene's a really unique community. They think they're just a bunch of special people down there that really care about their environment and nutrition for their kids, like a lot of communities. But in this particular community, I had a parent group that I worked closely with, and a lot of them worked in their school gardens. We had 19 school gardens at the time. There's more now. But just to work with the parent group and speak the same language of them and see how they worked, I decided I wanted to volunteer in as many of the gardens as I can and work shoulder to shoulder with them in a lot of their projects they had in school garden days. So I started doing that, and the more I did it, the more it just lit a passion in me, and I wanted to learn more. I became a master gardener there in Lane County, and you know, it really created a monster in that I became that nutty food service director that was passionate about getting any bit of school garden produce into the cafeteria and buying as much local as I can. So it really just changed the way I thought more and more, and it quickly took over my life in a good way.
Yeah, yeah. So Andy, Rick's story must be kind of familiar to you because you got your start on the other side as a Denver parent and school garden leader. So you started, as many parents do, at your own children's elementary school and then eventually led an expansion into how many schools in Denver?
In Denver Public Schools, we have over 70 school gardens out of a district of 85 elementary schools and 150-some overall schools. But we also support six other school districts in the Denver metro area with programming like we do for Denver Public Schools. And all those districts, the gardens are growing in size and number also.
Right. And you say we, you mean Slow Food Denver, correct?
Exactly. Slow Food Denver with our partners. Slow Food Denver is a very small grassroots nonprofit, and so it takes a lot of partnerships to pull that many gardens together and such. So we've got a lot of great partners in Denver, too.
Right, right. So when you began, were you doing it through Slow Food Denver, or were you an independent dad getting this thing off the ground, kind of more grassroots?
The very first garden at my kid's school, I was an independent dad. I was actually working as a teacher's aide in the school. We had just moved to Denver and wanted to get to know the school a little bit better. And I saw right away how much food was involved and food discussions was involved in their day-to-day curriculum, in their reading books and in their cultural studies and such. And so I suggested that I first started some cooking classes with the kids, and that led to the desire to have a garden to show kids where food came from. And so, I started for about a year before I became involved with Slow Food Denver.
Right, right. And then you were pretty well, long into the process of developing gardens at Denver Public Schools before you began talking to food service about moving student-grown fruit and vegetables into the cafeteria, So how many years in did that start happening?
So the garden started in 2001, and it wasn't until about 2009 before we were invited to the table to have discussions with food services and become one of their partners as they began a long process of transforming their school meal program to more locally fresh and produce overall.
Right, right. And so who started the conversation about getting the garden produce into
the cafeteria? That's a funny story in these parts. If you've ever heard of the movie Two Angry Moms, concerning the school meal programs, I was known as the angry dad here in Denver. And I was quite vocal about how disappointed we were that, about school meal programs in the early 2000s. We were growing all this great food in the gardens and the kids were eating it, but we weren't seeing it in the cafeteria. So it took the intervention of assistant superintendent to bring Slow Food and food service together in 2009 to start that conversation. And we had I still remember that meeting very well, and we discovered that we both have the same mission. We want to feed kids healthy food to give them the best chances for success in the classroom. And so from 2009, we began a process of figuring out how we could work together, using the success from our school gardens to support their plans to transform the food in the school meal program.
Right, right. And the school food service director at the time in Denver had an unusual proposition for you. He wanted to pay the gardens for the produce. Why?
Well, in 2009, Denver Public Schools became part of a national program called School Food Focus, and the intent of Focus was to get school districts to buy more locally grown food and raised animal products. And Slow Food Denver was the partner on that project. And so in the middle of that project, we were getting all this great food from the farms, And Leo Lesh, the food service director at the time, said, we should also get food from the school gardens because you guys are producing a lot of food. And he said, I'm paying the farmers for the food. I might as well pay the kids for the food, too. And I don't mean to imply that the kids are actually collecting the money. The money goes to the school gardens to support the supplies and the needs that they have on a year-to-year basis.
Right. But I understand that's pretty unusual for the district to actually be paying the gardens for produce.
I have not come across another program like that. As Rick and I are recently traveling and presenting these programs at national conferences, the fact that Denver Public Schools is paying for the produce raised quite the hubbub down in Austin at the Farm to Cafeteria Conference. And a lot of the garden leaders there were reporting that their directors saw this as a big challenge in getting the garden produce into the cafeteria.
Why? I mean, first of all, we're not talking about a lot of produce, right? As Rick said, sometimes it's a pan of lettuce.
In a typical year in Denver Public Schools, 20 school gardens may supply about $1,000 worth of produce, which doesn't even scrape the bottom of the bucket compared to how much produce the district buys on a yearly basis. There are strict procurement rules for food service directors to follow when they're using their USDA monies to buy fresh produce. And I think the overall feeling is that the buying from a school garden is still part of their procurement process. And what I'm trying to convince everybody is buying from the school garden is part of an educational process. Mm-hmm. And you're allowed to use your USDA money for educational purposes. And buying plants and seeds for school gardens is totally permissible by the USDA. And so I think it's just a natural extension to buy produce from the school gardens to show the kids that their hard work and that their efforts is meaningful and it contributes to the overall meal program in the district.
Right, and I know that Slo Food is interested, among other things, in having food justice incorporated into its garden kind of raison d'etre, its curriculum. So they're picking that up if they're aware that the district is paying them for their work.
So very, very true. We feel that everyone along the supply chain of food should get their fair, equal prices. And so, as we're engaging local farmers in discussions for farm-to-school programs and asking them to consider schools to be another market for their produce, we want the farmers to get a fair price for all the work that they put in. And so we believe that the kids, there are costs to school gardens. And right now, in general, districts don't pay for much of those costs. Those are still being generated by the parents and the volunteers out of the garden. And so we have to account for those costs. And food going into the cafeteria should have a cost to the program.
Right. Okay. Well, we're going to go to station break. And when we come back, we'll be talking about some logistics, including food safety. You're listening to Andy Nowak and Rick Sherman on Inside School Food. Stay with us.
Hi, I'm Jesse Kiefer, host of The Morning After. This summer, Heritage Radio Network is turning cinco. That's five for you non-Spanish speakers. Since our launch in 2009, we've continued to bring you food, culture, and content like nobody else, and we need your help. HeritageRadioNetwork.org is a passionate, grassroots, action-oriented nonprofit organization. That means we depend on the support from listeners like you to keep us alive. If you love what you hear on Heritage Radio Network, visit our website and become a member today. Thanks for listening, and thanks so much for your support.
Hey, my name is Betsy Andrews, executive editor of Severa Magazine, and I am hanging out at the coolest, most delicious place in the world, heritageradionetwork.org.
You're listening to Inside School Food. Today, a conversation about serving produce from school gardens in school meals with Andy Nowak, director of the National School Garden Program for Slo Food USA, and Rick Sherman, farm to school and school garden coordinator at the Oregon Department of Education. So, Rick and Andy, both of you have devoted enormous effort to designing and implementing food safety protocols for student gardens. It seems that food handling by children raises big concerns. In your experience, do concerns about food safety tend to inhibit the development of garden to cafeteria I don't know who wants to jump in here. How about you, Rick, for starters?
I would love to. When I was new to this position in Oregon, and actually the whole position in Oregon was new, when I started kind of delving into this area of getting the produce into the cafeteria, that was one of the arguments, the negative arguments I seemed to get from time to time, quite frequently actually, from more of the, maybe some of the food service directors or more likely some of the principals or administrations in some of the schools, was that there was a perception that, you know, I wanted to really emphasize a perception here, that food might not be safe to serve in the cafeteria, or there might be too much liability associated with it because it's not purchased from a bona fide, like, distributor or farm or whatever, and it was too loose. So that's when, I started looking into what I was currently using was just like a basic checklist that I developed for the past place that I work for. But I found out it was pretty inadequate, and it didn't answer all of the questions. And coming from a food service background and HACCP, Hazard Analysis Critical Control Point, that's the standard everyone uses in the industry, I started kind of having more of this checklist go into a whole training and documentation manual to take away that argument. Whereas, you know, every aspect of the garden produce is taken care of. Like, did you wash your hands when you harvested the food? Did you, how is the food, you know, brought into the cafeteria? Is it washed? You know, if you compost, what do you do with that compost? And this wasn't a quick and easy thing. This project took over a year, and Andy here was one of the instrumental folks, as well as about 50 other people from all over the country that helped me develop it and read it and reread it and edit it and edit it. And so now I've been having a lot of good use rolling this out in Oregon.
Right, right. And you said to me earlier with regard to a checklist, things that are not documented didn't happen. So if there, you know, there is some kind of a foodborne illness that occurs, the garden program is essentially protected if you can demonstrate that you've checked off everything with regard to food handling, right?
Yeah, in the National School Lunch Program, typically what happens is an entity like the county health inspectors come in twice a year and go through your operation, and they'll do surprise audits and look at your flow of the food through the establishment. And the one thing that I've kind of gotten loud and clear from these folks, which I've shared the program with a lot of county health officials, and they seem to really like it, but they typically don't care if food comes from a garden, school garden, or the distributor truck that comes in. They just want to make sure the food is handled correctly, and they want to go through, and you're exactly right. If they have that saying I've heard has come from county health officials that says, you know, if it's not documented, it didn't happen. There's no way you can prove that, you know, well, we've done this diligently. And they can look at these documents and tell if they're done correctly or if they're just like, you know, not done correctly. So it seems to work really well, and it takes away that argument that says, oh, there's no way we can have this as a reputable source, where, you know, we think it works well now.
Well, and it's a good protocol for volunteers, and, you know, that you have a lot of different people cycling in and out of the garden, students, volunteers, teachers. So there is one system everybody follows, and it's really straightforward. So I think getting it together may have been complicated, but it sounds like using it is pretty easy, right?
It only works if you use it. Mm-hmm. That's the first thing. And, it's something that you just shouldn't have on your shelf, but a working document, and you use it daily and weekly as you're doing your day-to-day things. I know operations are very busy, both in school gardens and teachers and nutrition services folks, and this isn't to be viewed as something that's like, oh, it's just one more thing I got to do. It's, you know, you're dealing with precious commodities and students, and you want to do everything you can to make sure that they're safe. And this is just one of those things that just realize that, you know, we need to take care of these things, and there's some training, and just do the documentation as it says, and it's a little peace of mind.
Right, right. So both you and Andy have put online, or I should say in Andy's case, it's the Denver Public Schools, have actually put their checklist and safety protocols online. And I will be posting those resources on the Inside School Food Facebook page. So and they are easily adapted from one setting to another. I imagine that there are regional differences with regard to certain requirements called for by public health authorities. You know, if for instance a district in Virginia wants to take the checklist that you've developed in Denver, Andy, where do they turn to make sure that it works according to the rules where they live?
Well, yeah, I've always said that what we develop in Denver just needs to be a template, needs to be the beginning of a discussion in your own community. Even here in Colorado, the rules change county to county. And while we have our template in every county now in the state of Colorado, I'm still advising schools and county health officials to sit down together and reexamine this document and adapt it to their needs within their county. It's a useful tool. It's a beginning point. It gets the discussion going, and that is often a hurdle. Rick and I are probably on the phone every week with different school districts wanting to get started with this, and they just don't know how to get started. So having a template at least gets the ball rolling, and it gives them some place to begin the discussion.
Right, right. So back to data. Research on the health impacts of school gardening is still in its infancy. But what we have so far suggests that children who garden at school are way less neophobic about trying produce, vegetables in particular, and much more likely to eat it. As for how student-grown produce in school meals affects fruit and vegetable consumption, we don't have data yet. But anecdotally, as Rick mentioned earlier, we're hearing a lot of good stuff about impact. You know, Rick and Andy, based on your experience, would you say that kids like seeing the food they've grown themselves on the salad bar? Like, you know, what happens? Rick, you mentioned what yep. happened in tell me about the Portland story you told me earlier. It was a great one.
Okay. And first of all, yeah, there is many studies, and the one that jumps out on me, there's one by the Journal of the American Dietetic Association. It finds that kids that are involved in the process of growing are more likely to have healthier diets. And if you want to read more about that, if you could Google that, American Dietetic Association, you know, garden, you'll probably go right to it. But that's exactly right. I was the other day I was at a school garden visit in Portland Public Schools, and they had a kale and pear salad on the line. And now typically it's been my experience, if you put something very healthy like that on there and just put it out there, the kids may or may not choose to take it. But if you have you know, a morning assembly about it, if that's something they have grown, like the story I shared about when I was in Eugene, they're very excited to try it. And when I was there, it was so funny. Not only was every kid choosing the kale and pear salad and loving it, the entire student body population, and there was over 600 kids at this elementary school, and there was a very high participation rate there. All the kids were eating. So not only were they eating it, there was a display table out front that had some fronds of kale and some pears there, and it wasn't intended to be a salad bar. It was a display to say, hey, today is our school garden day, you know, or whatever. Well, we turned around and looked, and the whole display was gone, and we saw kids walking around eating the entire, you know, fronds of kale, you know, the spine and all, and just saying how wonderful it was, you know. So it just goes to show, if you put a little effort into it and there's educational opportunities taking place, yeah, you see it wholeheartedly that the kids will make healthy choices.
Right, right. And Andy, you told me that in Denver, the salad bar will actually have like a point of service marketing, like a shelf talker kind of thing, to let kids know what items in the salad bar come out of the school gardens.
Well, yes, exactly. I believe that, you know, we need to market this within the school, with the students and the parents that visit at lunch, and even with the teachers. And so in Denver Public Schools, they've created these whiteboards that are attached to the beginning of the salad bar, and it'll say, you know, today on your salad bar, these items came from the school garden. And, you know, we tend to grow kind of unusual items in the gardens because we want to show kids about the variety of tomatoes and the different shapes and colors of cucumbers. And so it's, you know, on the salad bar, it's fairly obvious when the school garden produce is there, because with the yellow teardrop tomatoes or the lemon cucumbers, these are items that the school kitchens don't buy or don't even have access to through their vendors. And so the school garden produce really pops on the salad bar, and the kids get excited to see it.
Right. And I also just wanted to clarify, in the case of Denver, Slow Food Denver worked directly with School Food Service. But in your role with Slow Food USA, your new role, you're not working directly with districts anymore, right? So if a district is interested in the work you're doing, including there's a gorgeous manual for school gardens that Slow Food USA has produced, which I will put on the Inside School Food Facebook page. So districts that are interested in accessing those resources and getting help from Slow Food USA, who do they talk to? They talk to you or someone else?
Well, I'm just in the very beginning of this job, you know, kind of like Rick a year ago, and so I have a lot of work to do to get my chapters up and ready to handle discussions with food service directors. My goal is to eventually connect local school districts to their slow food chapter in the city, and that chapter then will be the conduit of information from my team down to the chapter, to the schools. In the meantime, I'd be very happy to talk to any directors that want, you know, further information about how slow food engages school gardens and works with school districts. And while I'm building the capacity of the slow food chapters, I'll have the capacity also to work with the districts, because I don't want to miss out on an opportunity to work with the district while my chapters are gaining in their capacity.
Yes,
to do
this job. That would not be your style, Andy.
No,
I said
not
you
at
were
all.
An Energizer Bunny. Well, and I should add that the manual is available to anyone. So even if a district is building their garden program without the help of Slow Food Chapter, the manual's there, and it's a fabulous tool. But, you know, you did emphasize earlier in the conversation, Andy, that it took you many years before you felt the Denver gardens were ready to work with School Food Service. So this is not something that a new gardening program should be jumping into from the get-go, right?
Well, when we started the gardens in 2001, and actually some of our partners had started a few years even earlier in Denver Public Schools, this is before school gardens were really part of the national discussion. You know, this is way before the White House garden that Michelle Obama put in. The edible schoolyard at that time was definitely the target school garden in the nation and such. But school gardens weren't really seen as a great resource for education or food for the cafeteria or anything back in the early 2000s. So it did take us a while to show the capacity of gardens, show that the students were excited to be in the gardens, that we could grow food, and that it could have a meaningful impact on the meal program, because the kids were learning that, you know, fresh food was great, great tasting, great for their bodies. And so, you know, since then, the gardens have matured. Gardens have grown up. And now gardens are, you know, supported by the USDA. There's national conferences on school gardens. Rick had a great conference in January for the Oregon School Garden Program. You know, so school gardens are definitely part of the conversation. And it's a lot easier in my mind these days for school gardens to get going, to have impact, to be involved in these programs, because a lot of the early programs really set the groundwork and the framework for these gardens to be successful.
Right. And I should add that your manual, the Slow Food USA Garden Manual, has tools that really reflect the maturation of the movement, including tools for putting evaluation into place, and which is really necessary now that gardens are taken more seriously to get and retain funding. You do need that, and you have developed that. So I encourage listeners to take a look at all of that. We have been speaking with Rick Sherman from the Oregon Department of Education and Andy Nowak from Slow Food USA about kids growing food for school meals. And it's a beautiful idea whose time has arrived. Thank you both for your tireless efforts, and thank you for joining us today.
Oh, you're welcome, Laura. It's a pleasure talking to you.
You've been listening to Inside School Food. I'm Laura Stanley. Next week, I'll be back with news from the School Nutrition Association's annual national conference in Boston.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.